All right. Good evening, everyone. Glad to see so many people survive after a whole day of sessions. I'm very happy to see people come to a deep dive. I'm not sure what the announced level is, but this is one of my typical level 666 talks. Maybe we'll take a look behind the scenes and how things work. I also thought to be fancy in days and years where Windows 10 anniversary update actually has blue screens with QR codes on it. If you've never seen it, that's a good thing. So I thought to just have a QR code over here, which links to a survey. There was some issue with the blue background, but I already have like 10 responses I see over here. So I'll just talk for like, 30 more seconds to allow some people to scan the code and actually bring a vote. And then we'll see what you pick, what we should be talking about. In fact, for the starters, I have, if you go to that website, something about C# 1.0 events, C# 2.0 anonymous methods, and C# 3.0 lambdas. Those are all pretty tasteful dishes. Then we have the main courses, where we can have object initializers from 3.0, generic variants from 4.0, and the brand new sexy local functions from C# 7. And then finally, two desserts, to just, end our day here. Either C# 6.0 exception filters or C# 7 type patterns. So let me actually quit out of this now and bring up the results. I have them on my phone already. That looks pretty good in my opinion. Okay. So we'll start with C# 3.0 lambdas, how those work. Pretty easy. Then we'll take a look at C# 4 generic variants. Okay, there's not that much to say about that, so maybe you can squeeze in a little bit of local function love as well. And then we'll finish with tasty type patterns. Okay, so let's get started with number one, C# 3.0 lambdas. In fact, for those of you who are interested about the other topics, C# 1.0 events, if you take a look at how events work, you will actually see that there is some interlocked voodoo behind the add and the remove method of events to ensure that you have thread-safe additions and removals of event handlers. Something you may want to take a look at by using something like ildasm or ilspy. C# 2.0 and 3.0 lambdas was really just to give you a choice of one menu, because C# 3.0 lambdas are kind of sexy syntax for C# 2.0 anonymous methods, with one exception, the support for something called expression trees, which I won't talk about here. Okay, so let's get started with C# 3.0 lambdas. So how many of you have actually been to one of my talks of this format? Okay, quite a few. So you know what you're up to, right? Okay, let's just get started with demo.cs. I don't have demo.cs, that's good. We'll just use Notepad. In this type of session, we don't use anything fancy like Visual Studio. We'll just do the bare minimal kind of thing in Notepad. We'll save it, we'll compile it using the command line compiler, and we'll investigate how the thing really works, okay? So I have a class demo over here. I'll just have static void main, of course, What better than spaces for indentation? And we'll have a func int f equals nothing goes to 42, okay? So that's the simplest lambda I can come up with. Actually, you could have a more simple lambda called an action delegate with nothing in the body. But, this is the closest approximation to something that does something useful. Opinions may differ on that subject, of course. So let's take a look at how lambdas work, okay? So as I compile this thing, just at the command line, let me actually also boost the font of this thing a little bit, maybe, so everyone can see everything that's going on here. So let me just compile this thing. I'll always compile it with O plus for the time being, which is turning on the optimizer. That's the same thing as you built in release mode in Visual Studio. And we'll just take a look using ildasm. How many of you know ildasm? Okay, everyone does, that's good. Well, not everyone, but most people. And so in ildasm, we can just see what's really going on here. And in fact, I'm pretty delighted. Actually, can everyone see that in the back, or do I have to do some voodoo to boost the font of that? Voodoo. Ooh. Okay, like voodoo it is. How does that work again on this thing? 36, maybe. Oh, that's good. Look at this. Such a primitive tool, but so good in UI design. So here we go. So this is the IL. Well, not the IL, that's the structure of the assembly. And what you see over here is actually a bunch of things that have changed recently in C# 6 and 7 with the introduction of Roslyn. There has been a couple of changes to the code generation happening for Lambda expressions. But the main thing here is that you have your main method, which I wrote myself, and then you will find those unspeakable names like B:00:0, which makes it look like two eyes with a flat nose in the middle. And then you have main on the left there. So whenever you see that in a call stack, things like, you know, less than main, larger than, you will actually know that this is an artifact that's generated for code that occurs in the body of the main method. Okay? And so that's actually my little piece of code here that actually loads a constant, 42. By the way, LDCI4S stands for load a constant of integer 4 bytes. The short means that the opcode can be short, meaning that 1 byte suffices to encode what the value is. 42 is less than 255, so that actually fits in a short, well, short opcode. And then we return. So that's just the body of my Lambda returning the constant 42. Nothing too exciting. And then what we see on top of this, and this is something that has actually changed recently, what you have with this whole less than, larger than C thing is actually a piece of code that has in it, as you can see over here, a variable, you know. And you see that we have that func backtick 1. Backtick 1 means a generic type of one, arity of 1, int32. So that's my func of int32, which my Lambda has to return, right? Like my Lambda is used to create a delegate of that type. And this will be a cache. So when you see this double, or this less than, larger than C type, which is relatively new, you will actually find caches for delegates. Why is that? Well, say that you have that Lambda sitting in the body of a for loop, right? You don't want to new up a new delegate instance for every single iteration of the for loop. So what we'll do at the place where we actually generate the code for the thing that news up the delegate, that's over here, the normal thing you would see is load ftm, which means load a reference to a function, and then do new opt to instantiate the instance of the delegate type. Okay? So the delegate constructor actually takes in a couple of things, including a reference to a function. So that's what new opt does. But in addition to all of this stuff, what we do is we actually also cache it. And what you see over here is hopefully relatively clear. We see LDSFLD, which means load static field. And we basically go to that less than, larger than C thing, that's our cache, and we're basically going to check in the cache. Oh, this thing doesn't support scroll, it's not that fancy. But so on the right-hand side, you see a cache for a delegate, and we just, you know, give that thing an unspeakable name. Caches start with 9, so less than, larger than 9 is a cache. And it has on the right-hand side of that __0_0, which is the first slot in our cache. So that's just a field that will hold a reference to that function delegate. And so the goal here is really, if this code would execute multiple times, it's the first one that will actually check over here whether this thing is not null. A non-null check is done using the branch true instruction. Everything non-zero is true. So then we'll just jump to 1C, and that's the end of my main method. Of course, I could have much more code there. Otherwise, we'll fall through this whole thing, and we'll actually load the instance of the cache, create our delegate instance using load ftn and new opt, and then ultimately do store static field into our cache. So a very important thing here, actually, is that when you create delegates, you don't have to do any kind of voodoo to sort of copy that thing out of a loop construct, for example. And some people actually have done that. I've seen that happen in the past. You know, say that you have something like this, and that's just a function over here that's actually, you know, not using any state. You know, it's not an instance function or something, it's just something that can be represented in a static method, this less than, larger than, or, you know, this Lambda that returns 42. Even if it sits inside the loop body, you don't have to worry about it instantiating multiple delegate instances. It will actually use the same one in the cache. And so one thing you could be doing, like, you know, tonight, if you don't have anything else to do, which should not be the case because we're all developers. What you can do here is like basically go through that loop body and actually store those delegate instances in some hash set, and you will actually see that the hash set only contains one value, right? Because those will all be instance equal. Like, you know, we'll be using the cache here to create those delegate instances. So this does not cause an allocation hell, this type of code. Now, that's a very simple Lambda, okay? Now, let me actually make, first of all, add some power to my laptop here, because otherwise we're going to have a problem at some point. Okay, yeah, that's good, it's charging. Let me make it a little bit more complex, okay? The more complexity that I want to add here is the following. Let me actually have another method here. Static func of int f, you know. Let me take it in x. You know, so now you have a local x over here. And let me just return a lambda that returns x like this. Okay. So this is just something that, given an int, will return a function that will return that int. Okay. What's happening here is that we're actually referring to a variable which is not in the scope of my lambda. Right? I don't have something here like, well, I could make it even a little bit more complex. You know, I could say func int of y goes to x plus y. Right? This is something, given a value, will return a function. When you execute that function with a parameter, it will add the two things together. And so what you see is y is actually in scope of my lambda, pretty easy. But x actually comes from the outer scope. Right? And so if you now think about this in a more native way, like, you know, think about, you know, stack allocated memory and heap allocated memory and all of that stuff, you'll inevitably come to the conclusion that this x needs to live somewhere else than the stack, right? Because when you call f and you push something on the stack containing the value of x, and then you return a delegate, that stack frame is gone. So the stack frame containing the value of x is gone. And yet you want to be able to execute this function maybe 2 months later, you know, if you store it somewhere and then you want to execute it, we still need to have that value of x available. So what's happening here is we actually create a closure, which is just something out of the functional programming literature. In fact, it goes back all the way to the lambda calculus, you know, from the 1930s. So that's a notion from there. And so closures basically allow you to sort of capture an environment that goes with that function. And so what's going to happen here is the generation of a closure, which in C# is called display class. Long story about how that name came about. It's actually some incident that happened with the debugger team that had to implement part of the support for closures to make it look nicely in the debugger. And they said, well, we need to have something special to display the variables in a closure. Let us call it a display class. And so the name stuck. So we're now stuck with the name display class. So let me actually compile this thing and see what's going on, okay? So let me just close all of this stuff. Oh, it will not remember it because ILSpy has some, or ILDASM has a quirk that if you don't run it as admin, it doesn't remember the font size. not that good, actually, in retrospect. But we should change that at some point. Now you can do it. It's all open source on GitHub, so if you have nothing else to do besides looking at closures tonight, you can submit a pull request for ILDASM. But so what's happening now is we have this f function which returns a func of int to int, right? Pretty easy. But now in addition to our thing that in the past just was a cache, we now have something else. We have the C double underscore display class 1_0. Ignore those numbers. You know, that doesn't really matter. But so what you see now is that the display class thing is actually something that has a public field in it called x, which is my used to be local allocated on the stack, has now moved into a display class. And notice that this class is actually a class. You can see dot class on it, so it's a heap allocated object. And then we have our function b double underscore zero, which is the function that I'm returning, which takes in an int32 for parameter y, and then wants to return an int32. Well, how does that thing work? Basically says load arg0, which means load this, then load the field containing x, then load the argument that's passed in, that's y, add the two together and return it. So you see now that our function sort of carries a heap allocated object on its back, which contains the value of x, right? So that x got what we call hoisted to the heap. It used to live on the stack, and it gets moved to the heap. So the important thing here is actually that when you have those lambdas that actually capture variables, you're causing heap allocations, right? And if you do a lot of those, you know, delegate allocations, you may actually be causing a lot of garbage collection to happen. So be a little bit careful about those things, and there's a bunch of lessons that you can learn from that, but that's basically the essence. Now let me actually show you one thing that's interesting. Say that you have this, right? And you have something like this, you know? If x is larger than zero or whatever, you know, or, you know, if extremely rare condition of x, you know, based on a value x, then you want to return some function that has a closure, right? That does return y goes to x plus y. In another case, you know, we're just going to do else, return, you know, whatever. Like, you know, y goes to, you know, y plus 1. Not using x at all. If that's the case, and you have code that looks a little bit like this, you may want to think about how you structure your code if you're really performance critical. If you're not performance critical, you don't have to worry about this. But if you're sort of in the core of a framework, like the .NET framework, we have a bunch of places in, for example, task of T, where if we go down a certain branch, we have to store that value in a closure. But in the typical case, in the sunny day scenario, we go down some other code path, and there's no need for X to end up on the heap, because we never need to sort of reference to it from some lambda that we need to store on the task pool or whatever. So in that case, we'll actually refactor this piece of code into separate methods. Why? Because if you create a separate method for this, like, you know, and actually if you look at the .NET source code, you can find things like methods that end with, you know, search for methods that end with rare or that end with slow, you know, those kind of methods, which are exceptional cases that we know are much slower and much more expensive. But those will actually do all of the work that causes that heap closure to be created. So what you will write is something like this, you know, f rare, like this, and then you will do over here return f rare of x. And the result of that is that x does not get allocated on the heap, it doesn't get moved to the heap, unless you're inside that method called frare, which actually has to do that. So that cost of actually allocating something on the heap that contains a local, you kind of want to avoid it unless you absolutely need it. And so this is kind of, you know, one of those things where, you know, C# has language features, just like C++ and JavaScript, actually JavaScript even worse in my opinion. You know, there's a lot of language features that actually have a lot of hidden cost. And typically it doesn't matter that much, you know, for a lot of cases. But if you're building a tight framework, you may want to be aware of like when those things happen. And in fact, if you go online in the Visual Studio Gallery, you can find code fixes and code analyzers for Roslyn that actually point out those places where you have crime scenes in your code, like the heap allocation analyzer and those kind of things. And so those would actually show you this interesting behavior. So correctness, of course, is all good. You know, expense could be of interest in certain cases. So that's, in a nutshell, lambdas. So what have we learned? The allocation of the delegates, you know, we try to cache as much as possible, especially if you have a delegate that points to a static method. You know, we'll try to actually cache that and reuse it in that, you know, less than larger than C class. If you have some state that you reference to or are referencing from the body of the lambda expression, you will actually cause a heap allocated closure called display class to be created. And in fact, if you look at call stacks, you may have seen that name before, right? Like, I bet like many of you have seen display class, right? Like, you know, in a call stack. Yeah, so now you know where those things come from. Those come from lambdas that actually close over some state that needs to outlive the current stack frame. And so that's what those closures actually look like. Now, let's actually take a look at the second thing that people asked for, generic variants. And the good news about generic variants is that it's a very brief topic. And I sort of squeezed that in there because, you see, the second most popular thing is local functions. And I wanted to say a little thing about local functions because they completely align with this notion of lambdas. They use the very same technique as lambda expressions, but they do it in a cheaper way. So let me show you local functions really quick, okay? So a local function is something new that we have in C# 7, right? So let me just do static void local func, you know. And what you can do here is you can basically just say, you know, int f int x goes to, or let me just do the same as I had before, you know, goes to y plus x. Let me make this thing take in x or something. And then inside of it, I will just do f of 5. Why would you do that? Well, maybe for whatever reason you think that the plus operator is way too complex to stand on its own, so you want to refactor it into some local function. You know, that's the new feature, which enables you to sort of have little helper functions that have no value outside the method and sort of, you know, declare them inside the method, okay? So that's a local function. But now if you look at this whole thing, it looks an awful lot like a lambda. In fact, you could have used return over here as well, you know, but it doesn't matter. So you have this whole thing sitting here, and it looks a lot like a lambda, right? Because I have this arrow syntax, and I have y, which is a local, right, this thing, okay, that comes in as a parameter to this function. But then I also have plus x on the right-hand side. Now, what does that mean? Well, in the lambda case, you would actually have said, well, that's creating a closure, right? Like, because that x, you know, if I return that delegate to my caller, that x still needs to be alive. So I need to move it to the heap, where it can live longer than the current stack frame. But in this case, it's a local function. The keyword here is local. This thing cannot leak out of your function. It can just use the current stack frame to do all of its magic. So what's going to happen here? We are going to use the same techniques as for lambdas to build a little struct that actually holds all of those local variables that are sort of referenced from local functions. Because, of course, at some point I may want to do x++ in my other method. I can sort of use those variables in many places, not only in the body of my local function. So what are we going to do? We are going to create a storage location for x in a display class. But the trick is going to be that the display class will be a struct as opposed to a heap allocated class. So local functions, actually, unlike lambdas, because they only can be used locally within a method, can apply an optimization that gets rid of all of that, you know, heap allocation concerns that I was sort of talking about just a moment ago. Let me actually compile this thing, and I'm pretty sure that I won't be able to compile it because, indeed, you know, this is not using Roslyn 7.0, C# 7.0. But I have a copy of the C# compiler sitting somewhere. Actually, let me just open it in Visual Studio. Why not? Oh my God. What was I doing here? What was I thinking? What's the best way of doing this? One moment, you know. I can go to my freshly compiled version of the .NET compilers in this folder. This is as recent as this morning. I'll just go there and I'll use this CSC, which is the Roslyn compiler containing C# 7.0 features. And I'm just going to compile c:temp-demo.cs over here. I'll get my local function support now. It's a little slower because it's a debug build, but whatever. There we go. Blah, blah. There's an error. Local func returns void. What am I doing wrong? You know, that's always the nice thing. Local func returns void, and I'm returning something that's non-void. That's the problem. Okay. Extremely rare condition of x does not exist. I should maybe get rid of this whole other slew of stuff. You know, let me just comment it out like this. There we go. It's gone. Compile again. And now we can take a look at what that local function does. And you will see it does exactly the same thing with one difference. Obviously, otherwise I wouldn't be pointing it out. If you take a look here. This thing sucks at this point. So you know what to do, right? You know. Here we go. Look at this. Can you see the difference? The color of that little icon on the left is different. That means it's a struct. Little subtle. But it says dot class value, which means it's a struct. And so we have, again, a display class, which really should be called a display struct at this point, but whatever. It's an internal implementation detail. It extends from system.value type, which means it's a struct. It has x in it, public int 32. And then you have my local function here, which actually doesn't have a b underscore name, but a g underscore name, because we always like to use different, you know, secret names for things. They're not secret, they're just open source, right? You can totally find out what G means and C and B and so on. But so you have that local function here. And notice what it does. In the past, a method that was actually using something on the display class, a lambda that's using the display class, was just an instance method on the display class. This one is not an instance method. It's actually a static method sitting next to the method where I create that local function. And it takes in, over here, my value type display class ampersand, which means it takes in a ref to that struct. So you have something on your stack. It contains x. You pass a reference to that struct to your local function. And now the local function can just get into x, and it's just addressing stack memory. It never evacuated the whole shebang to the heap. Right? It's all stack allocated memory. So a local function doesn't really cost you anything, or not much at least. You know, you will have a little struct allocation on the stack, but there's no garbage collection implications and what have you. And then the local func over here, the one that instantiates this thing, basically just instantiates that display class, stores x into that field, a bunch of knobs because I didn't run it with the optimizer turned on apparently, and then you know for the rest you know you have a whole bunch of code in here which deals with that display class, which is really a struct on the stack. So local functions are kind of using exactly the same mechanism as lambda expressions and anonymous methods. The only thing we've done is we sort of changed the code emit for display class to become a struct, like in that particular case. So it's all the same code, really. Now, of course, one thing you can do, and that's where I will end on this note, one thing you could do is you could say, well, at some point, I would like to have a func int int delegate called f, which refers to f. Could totally do that, or you could write it in an alternative way if you like, you know, using the classic C# 1.0 syntax. Right? So you're capturing a delegate to the local function, and that's supported as well. But of course, once you do that, it has implications, right? You can guess the implications. X now needs to have lifetime that's the same as the delegate. The delegate is heap allocated, so the lifetime of X needs to be heap allocated as well. So you can pass the delegate around and use it much later. So as soon as you use a local function and you capture it inside a delegate, for example, for an event handler registration, you will cause heap allocation. Yep. Reference? Oh, why does... yep. Ah, okay, why is the struct passed by reference? That's because of the semantics of closures in C#. You want to have the illusion that everyone can actually write to the same memory, right? Like if you do x++ over here, right? If I pass in 3 and I have a local function that given 5 will do 5 plus whatever is in x, and I increment 3 to 4, then this function should return 9 and not 8. So all the writes to x, whether they're inside the local function, whether they're outside the local function, they all need to point to the same memory. If you would be passing the struct by value, you would get a copy, and it would be working on copies. In C#, you don't have any way to control that. In C++, for those of you who do C++, they have this funky syntax, right? You know, that's a lambda in C++, right? You know, and over here you can say capture variable x by reference or capture it by value. In C#, it's always by reference. Like, you know, it means that x has the same storage location no matter where you're using it from. You never create copies. And so that's why we have to do that heap allocation as well. That's what's going on here. And so if you do this, let me now just show this really quickly. If I compile this whole thing, you still know what it looked like, right? Over here. Just notice the color of that display class thing. I won't boost the font here, but like it's brownish, yellowish or something. As soon as I now capture it inside a delegate, then X has to have a lifetime that's the same as the delegate, and it becomes blue. Our display class becomes a class again, because you're doing something that will need the lifetime of that variable to be longer than just being stack allocated. So when you use local functions, by default, it will be stack allocated unless you give us reasons to evacuate that stuff to the heap because you want to use a delegate pointing to that local function. Okay? So that's what's going on here. Conclusion, if you want to use local functions as a way of refactoring your code in the future in C# 7.0, by all means do so. Like you don't really have a performance penalty in doing it. Okay? So that's local functions. C# variants, it's a pretty simple thing. How many of you know variants? Yeah. Okay. I'll just show you how subtle it is at the IL level. Okay. So the notion of variants is really, if you have, say, you know, collections generic, that's the simplest way I can come up with. And you have an IEnumerable of person, people, and you give it students, right? And then you have over here static IEnumerable of, I don't need to do it like that, I can do it over here. IEnumerable of students equals new student array of 0. By the way, in C# or .NET 4.6 point something, you have array.empty of student as well, right? I recommend you to use this one. It's actually another little interesting thing. We now have a singleton type for empty arrays, because it turns out that if you take a look at typical heap, people tend to create a lot of empty arrays. Why? Because sometimes you have methods that take in params arrays, right? Little detour here. Public void f params object array objects, right? Something like this. And then you call f with nothing. The old compiler would actually do f of new object 0 there, because it didn't pass anything. It needs to create an empty list, right, or an empty array. Starting with, you know, recent versions of the compiler and recent versions of the .NET framework, it will actually emit this code instead, okay? To basically use a singleton of an object array containing nothing, which means if you have a lot of people like calling things like, I don't know, string.format with no parameters or something, and the format string doesn't contain formatters, then you would have an empty array of string. Well, if everyone does that, you have a lot of heap allocations for empty arrays. So like array.empty actually just introduces singletons on a per type basis for empty arrays. Now, that doesn't really matter that much in this case, but you know, I thought it was just fun to point it out, you know, that that's a little optimization that's happened very recently. So if you do new student 0 or student 1 or something, you can write this piece of code. And of course, it assumes that you have a class student, which inherits from person, and then you have a class person like this, right? And the reason you can do that is because IEnumerable just allows you to consume values, right? It allows you to get values out. And if you give me a student, if I just want to look at the student as a person, fine. Like, there's no safety problems with that, right? The opposite thing, if you want to compare something, and you want to compare two students, for example, now I have to be very careful that I don't get it backwards, right? If you have an iComparer, right, that allows you to compare two things of a certain type, you can give it more derived things in the input, right? If you want to compare two objects, you can give it two strings. That's not a problem. Okay? So that's called co and contravariance. And now, the way this actually works is that the CLR's type system is very sophisticated in allowing certain assignments. Like this one over here, this assignment doesn't really cost you anything. Why? Because an object of type IEnumerable of student at the runtime level can be converted to IEnumerable of person, provided that person is actually a base class of students. And the way the CLR knows that is by having those annotations. So if you've ever seen those annotations, like I have an iFoo, which has an out parameter t, that means, you know, I'm covariant. That means if you have an iFoo of student, you can assign it to an iFoo of person. You also have the opposite thing with in, you know, if you have something exactly the opposite thing, right? Like if you have an, let me call it an i bar of n of t, meaning that's contravariant. That's exactly the opposite direction of the inheritance relationship. And that's, for example, a comparer, and iFoo is a good example of that. It's actually IEnumerable of t. Now, if you ever find yourself in IL and you want to see whether this thing is actually co or contravariant, you can actually do so quite easily. I hope everything compiles now. I think it will. Let me just compile this thing again. Here we go. Generics doesn't work. Collections.generic, singular. Okay. ildesmdemo.exe. There you go. That's the syntax for co and contravariant. Okay. I should really change this. I've gotten tired of it. I will submit the pull request tonight. But you see it over here, like, you know, you have the minus and the plus on the right-hand side. The minus, you know, for I bar actually says in, means you can give me something less derived. On the other side, you can give me something more derived and it's fine. So this minus and this plus thing is basically the subtle hint at the IL level about this whole thing. In fact, if you use TypeScript, how many of you are using TypeScript? You actually also have co and contravariance on the generic types over there. It uses the extents keyword on the generic parameter to say this thing shall derive from that particular type. That's actually a subtyping constraint that you can put there. And this is pretty much the same type system theory behind that. Like, you know, if you give me a person or if you give me a student, I can deal with it as if it's just an ordinary person. Like, you know, you don't really care. Okay? So that's co and contravariance in a nutshell. And it's a very deep thing at the runtime level. It means those assignments don't cost you anything. It's not like there's an implicit conversion of every single element in that array, you know, to sort of upcast it, you know, or cast it back to person in this case. So very low level supported feature, which is visible starting with C# 4.0. So that's actually variance. Local functions, again, as you've seen, use the same techniques as lambda expressions and anonymous methods, but you know they don't really come with the performance penalty. And then finally, a little dessert, C-sharp 7.0 type patterns. How many were in my C-sharp 7 talk? So you already know what's going on there. Let me just try to see the forest for the trees over here, because I have so much stuff already. I'll just add something to the top, right? Static void bar. It's always good to have a bar, right? So static void bar object O, what you can do now in C-sharp 7 is you can say if O is int x, okay? And then you can do inside of here, console write line x, right? I'll put this indentation on my clipboard for simplicity purposes, okay? And then, you know, in the other case, let me say if O is a string s, right? Do console write line of s, okay? So that's something you can do now. In the past, you could just do is, but you couldn't give it an identifier name, so you couldn't actually introduce a local which contains the result of the conversion. So how does this work is now the question, of course. Well, it turns out it's almost what you would expect to write yourself, but you know there's a couple of interesting cases here. For example, the first one, this O thing. If it's an int, of course, a boxed integer, you want this check to pass. But what about the nullable integer? Right? Nullable integer. If it's not null, that check should pass as well, and it should extract the value out of the nullable. Right? If you have an int question mark containing 42, do you want that first thing to pass as well? And in the second case here, well, as I have shown before, if you would want to write that yourself, you know, before C-sharp 7, and you want to do it in an efficient way, you would want to use the as keyword, right? You would want to say O as string, and then assign it to some local that you've introduced, and then say if it's not null, then you want to use it. Why would you do all of that voodoo? Very simple reason, because if you do an is followed by a cast, you're really sort of asking the common language runtime to check for the typing relationship twice, and that can be costly in tight code. So the C-sharp compiler tries to make the best of this, and in fact there's still a bunch of work left to do, because with this whole feature of pattern matching, you may have a lot of patterns that share the same evaluation code. You may have something like switch O case string s when s.length is larger than 0. Case string s when s not equals empty. Well, whatever, that's the same case in this one, right? But like, so in those cases, we want to reuse the same type check, of course. Like, it's as if you're building nested if statements, one that checks whether it's a string, and then if it's a string, you want to do if s.length is larger than 0, then do this, otherwise do something else and whatever. So there's a lot of optimization stuff still happening in the implementation. Let me just show you how this works, okay? So I have a very simple method called bar, takes in an object O, and I do two checks and assignments to locals. So as I compile this thing, let me actually do it with the optimizer turned on again. And in fact, for this one, we could just use ILDASM. ILDASM is also great because, you know, if you use it long enough before a new language is out, it's not smart enough yet to decompile stuff. And in this case, it's not smart enough yet. So if you go here, and I actually have it set to decompile as IL, but I will decompile it as C#, and of course make the display bigger again. You know, that's really something I should have done before. You know, I'll punish myself tonight for not doing that. But over here, you have your bar object, and you can sort of see the equivalent C# code, because this thing is not good enough yet, like, you know, to sort of recognize all those pattern matching things. And so what you see over here is, indeed, for the first one, right, naively you would think the check you want to do there is to check whether O is an int and nothing more. But we do a little bit more. We actually check whether it's an int question mark, okay? Nullable ints should also work fine if they're not null. Like, you know, that's a case you may forget about if you do something general purpose like this. And so then we just fish out the get value or default, all that kind of stuff, and do, you know, when, whether it has a value or not. And then, you know, if it has a value, we do this. It also uses certain code emission patterns that the just-in-time compiler can optimize when it's emitting native assembly instructions. So you will actually see certain intrinsics being used, like get value or default and what have you. So that's the case for value type checks. It will actually use the nullable variant of the value type, and then, you know, check whether it has a value. Of course, you can also do, you know, if O is int question mark yourself, and then you also want to get, you know, all the cases. And on the right-hand side, or the second case better, the second case is pretty much doing that thing you would have to do yourself, right? Where you introduce a local variable somewhere, and then you want to just do as only once, and then check for null, as opposed to doing is and a cost. So that's really, you know, what this this code sort of compiles into. And so the key thing here is that all of this pattern matching stuff that's coming is actually meant to be quite efficient. You know, you would be able to write it yourself, and we can do an awful lot of things, because if you have rich pattern matching and you check the same case multiple times, well, we have to evaluate the whole thing top to bottom. But there's nothing preventing us from caching stuff. If we've already done one OS string and assign it into a local, if we know we've already done that, and in a further pattern, deeper down in your code, you want to make the same check, you don't have to fear about incurring the same cost twice, because this thing doesn't really have a side effect. You know, it will not throw an exception at a different time or something. So we can cache a whole bunch of things, make it an efficient evaluation strategy. Yep. Yeah, that's a good question. Like, you know, why didn't we optimize things away? Well, you know, there's a bunch of corner cases to do with nulls and all of that kind of stuff. So, like, you know, really, you know, optimizing it away, if you have a null, right, and you do a cast from some object that's null to a certain type, right, you end up with null. So we still need to add a null check and all that kind of stuff. Now, you're right, you know, there are places where we could have done more optimization kind of things. And, you know, it turns out it's always like an interesting kind of balance, like, you know, how many of those optimizations that you do and all that kind of stuff. And there was a pretty easy way out. It's not the most fancy way. But now with C# 7, yeah, we're sort of like investing a lot also in performance teams. Like, you know, a good example of that is the introduction of value task, like for, you know, a stack allocated task in case it's already completed. So there's really a new language design team, which is kind of a meta theme, which is about like making C# a high performance language, you know, that you can use, you know, for gaming engines and that kind of stuff. And so that's actually one of the motivations for a lot of this, you know, higher levels of abstraction that allow us to do a lot of optimizations, like, you know, reducing, you know, redundant checks and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, very good question. Any other questions about, like, you know, type switches? The same thing happens, by the way, if you use the switch statement, right? If you use switch, you can also use all of those patterns, like, you know, switch int I, switch string s. You can do all of that. And the only difference, which is interesting to point out, is if you actually use switch O, like in the past, you could do case 1 and case 2, assume that O is an integer. Like in the past, this wouldn't have worked because O is of type int, of type object in this case. But like in the past, if you would be writing this, it would emit very efficient switch table code. Like, you know, it would build up a switch table, would build up a decision tree as well. That sort of, there's a whole bunch of you know, interesting optimizations. It still does that if you do a switch with only constant cases. But of course, if you do a switch which has something like case exception E, case invalid operation exception E, and so on. Once you do that, of course, the order matters, right? Like, you know, this case cannot be reached because every invalid operation exception is also an exception, right? So now the order matters. Like, you know, if you use this with type checks and patterns, it evaluates top to bottom. If you just use constant cases, it's still the good old switch, you know, that you know, can do unordered evaluation and all that kind of stuff because they're constant cases and the order doesn't matter. So meta lesson here is actually, as you start writing those fancy, you know, decision things, you're giving us more food for optimization, because, you know, repeated cases, we can actually lift out and sort of, you know, do interesting stuff with. Okay, so that's actually type switches and type checks and all of that, and that's really the beginning of a larger language design team called pattern matching capabilities, and you can learn much more about it on github.com/.NET/Roslyn. Go there to the issue tracker, take a look at the language design notes, you will actually see where we sort of want to go with all of this. And I can only conclude that it's a great time to be a C# developer. There's a lot of stuff happening to make your code more concise, but also more performing. And that also means that it's a pretty good cotton industry for language internal stocks like this one, because, you know, there will be a lot of more interesting things that the compiler does to get pretty rich syntactic constructs and quite concise constructs compiled into very efficient code. And so I hope with this that at least you have some, you know, tendency to look a little bit behind the scenes. Like, you know, when you have some new language feature, the first thing I do is let's compile this and take a look at the IL code it generates. Like, you know, how does this thing work? And sometimes there are interesting pitfalls, like lambda expressions with closures that could cause heap allocations to happen that you didn't expect. But in some other cases, you are pleasantly surprised. Like, if you take a look at a lot of the new features that are coming out, they're actually designed with a whole bunch of performance constraints in mind so that the abstractions become very affordable. Okay, with that, I'm actually at the end. I have two more talks tomorrow, one similar to this, but then about the .NET framework, .NET framework internals. We will take a look at some esoteric types that most people don't meet on a day-to-day basis, but that may still be interesting. And then we'll also have a talk in the morning about Roslyn, how to build custom analyzers in Visual Studio that actually use the .NET compiler platform and Roslyn, so you can actually plug in to the C# and Visual Basic compilers in a rather straightforward manner. Okay, thanks. Thanks for staying this late, and hope you have a good evening.